About Gezerot Akum. Gezerot Akum. Okay, decrees against Goyim. Alright? namely, Pat Akum, Bishel Akum, Cholav Akum, and other Akums. Okay, we'll start first with Pat Akum. And Chazal made a Gezerah not to eat the bread of a baked by a non Jew. And the reason given by most Rishonim, actually, so Gemara mentions this, Mishum Chatnut. Literally, Chatnut means that Chazal were made a Gezerah in order that Jews not go to eat together with non-Jews, lest they intermarry. Chatnut means to intermarry. The Ramah comments that even in a situation where there's no chash of intermarriage, like, you know, your next door neighbor doesn't have any daughters, it's still awesome. The Rambam in the Pirsh Mishnayim of Avodah Zarah mentions that Mishum Chatnut is not really limited to actual intermarriage. Mishum Chatnut means lest you pick up from the culture of the non-Jew. So it's interesting that the Rambam be the one that pointed out. In other words, the Rambam understands the reason for the Gezerah is not to fraternize with non-Jews, because you might pick up negative aspects of non-Jewish culture. Okay, a little ironic in Western culture today, Jews in Western culture today. In any case, so the Gezerah was that you're not allowed to eat bread baked by a non-Jew. We're talking about a situation where there's not a chashash of kashrut at all. There's no chash of kashrut, you're still not allowed to have the bread. The definition of bread is bread that's made out of the five types of grain. In other words, if you have bread made out of, I don't know, corn bread as an example, then it wouldn't fall under the gzera of parakum. And the reason why Chazal chose bread specifically is because of its chashivut, the fact that it's the center of the meal itself. Yes.
What counts as baking? Like, what is going to do to be considered to be part of the
once
process?
He bakes it to the point of being edible.
If he prepares.
Oh, I'm going to get to that. Okay, bread that's baked by a professional baker is called pat palter. A palter is a professional baker. So according to the Ramah, that's mutter. In other words, Chazal weren't gozer in the situation of a professional baker. Only home baked bread was under the gzera. The Shach says that this heter of eating pat palter is only if there's no Jewish bread available. In other words, it's not a situation that's lechachila, but if there's no other Jewish, if there's not Jewish bread available, or even if the Jewish bread is inferior, then a person could use pat palter even according to the Shach. Now, what is the definition of baking? So, if a Jew has anything to do at all with the process of the baking, either by turning on the fire, or putting the bread into the oven, or even throwing a twig into the fire and somewhat increasing the fire in even a minuscule amount, that already renders it not pat akum anymore. Also, specifically the gzera par akum, as opposed to the other gzera we're going to mention about, or we're going to talk about, par akum is a gzera de rabbanan of the nature that is batel barov. As if you had, I don't know, two loaves of Jewish bread and one loaf of non-Jewish bread, so to speak, that were identical and they got mixed up, so rov would allow you to eat the loaves of bread. Okay? And that's the gzera par akum. The next gzera I want to talk about is bishul akum. Yes?
Do we pass on the shark by
Yes. L'chatchila, yes. There was an issue that came up in England recently, right? When you had you all of a sudden had non-Jewish commercial breads available, which is pot palter. There was a whole outcry, what's going to happen to all the Jewish bakeries, Brzezinski's, etc., right? So that's pot palter. Okay, anyway, next is bishul akum. The reason for the gezeira, bishul akum basically is a gezeira against eating food cooked by a non-Jew, even when there's no question of the ingredients, meaning even if it's 100% kosher as far as the ingredients is concerned. According to most Rishonim, it's again because of chatnut, although Rashi says it's also a chshash of kashrut. Now Rashi understands that the reason for gezeira was because of a chshash of kashrut, but most Rishonim say it's because of chatnut, in order that we not socialize with non-Jews. Now I would like to define bishul akum with five definitions. The first, A, definition of bishul akum is something that is not consumed raw and is now cooked by a non-Jew. So let's say it might, you know, include a baked potato, but it doesn't include cooked carrots or cooked peas, because both carrots and peas are consumed raw. A more relatively recent development, human beings are more increasingly ingesting raw fish of different types in sushi, right? So that would also be, you know, if that particular type of fish, like tuna or like salmon, I don't know all the different types of fish that they use, but I know that they use tuna and salmon for sure in sushi. What else do they use? Yota, I think, is a type of tuna. And yota is a type of tuna. What?
Tilapia.
Who?
Tilapia.
Tilapia, that's the name of a fish?
Yeah. Tilapia.
Okay, what kind of fish is that?
It's like a flounder.
It's a fly fish. But it's not a flounder.
It's not a fluke,
it's not a flounder.
No. Right.
What country does it come from?
I have no idea.
Ask a question.
No, that's very relevant. That's very relevant. Because if what you're saying is true, it's a type of a sole, so then I would imagine that would also extend to flounder and to fluke, that sole is also falls under the category. The point being that if these types of fish are consumed raw, so there wouldn't be a gzeirat bishul akum on, you know, if they cook those fish. If a goy would cook either salmon or tilapia or tuna, etc., there wouldn't be a problem of bishul akum. I remember a discussion once many years ago where the Rav of Alon Shvut told the makolot they had to remove a whole bunch of canned mushrooms from the shelves because there was a problem of bishul akum. And I asked him, I said, "What mushrooms, you know, people eat mushrooms raw." And he looked at me like I was nuts, like nobody, you know, no one eats mushrooms raw. People in salads. People eat mushrooms raw in salads. Now, it doesn't mean that if you decide that you want to start, let's say, sucking on eggs or things like that, that means that you would be able to, you know, have a scrambled egg made by a guy, it's a problem with bishul akum. When I was, 30 years ago in the yeshiva, they discovered that one of the Arabs was actually putting the eggs in, you know, to be boiled. I guess the guy who ran the kitchen didn't realize that you can't do that. They discovered there was a problem with bishul akum. So, So the first definition is that bishul akum has to be something that was cooked by a non-Jew of a type of food that is not at all, is not consumed raw. Okay? Second definition, yes? Second definition. It has to be a gourmet type of food. In other words, it has to be, in the Lashon Chazal is Ole al Shulchan Melachim. It has to be a type of food that would be served at the table of a melech, which I think the modern translation of that would be gourmet food. So that if you're talking about, let's say, hamburgers or hot dogs or French fries, that is not gourmet food. Even if nowadays, you know, all they talk about gourmet French fries or gourmet hamburgers, there's no such thing, right? Okay, fish and chips is not considered gourmet fare. And therefore, the gezeira does not apply to food of that type. But somebody once asked me, well, what about canned food? In other words, a gourmet wouldn't eat mushrooms out of a tin, out of a can. I don't have an answer to that. I'm not sure if that's exactly the same thing. Okay, it's not a type of food. That's just the way the food was prepared. It was prepared badly. So I don't know whether that would disqualify it from being an issue of official outcome. Yes, Zach? Okay, next definition. Yes, huh? No, what about eggs? You don't think that the queen eats an omelet? Of course the queen eats an omelet. Of course she would eat a hard-boiled egg. If she wanted one. Not al shulchan lachim. She might, like, you know, try to look like a commoner. Maybe she wants to look like a commoner just to be with the people, but, you know. And definitely not wrapped up in newspaper. Yes?
Why would it matter where tilapia was from?
No, I'm just questioning because I didn't know what type of food, what type of fish it is.
It's an exotic fish from Africa that was introduced to temperate freshwater climates.
Yeah, have you consumed tilapia?
Yes.
Oh, so you know that it's kosher?
Yes.
Is there a picture there of it?
No, I don't think so.
There is a picture, it's just
it looks like a fluke.
Have a picture.
No, I don't have a picture. I've seen it before.
So I'm saying it matters. In other words, the question is whether you could throw fluke and flounder in the same category. If it's, you know, you don't think that you could use fluke or flounder as sushi.
I don't think there are cases where tilapia is much more flavorful.
How do you know? You've ever sucked on raw fluke or raw flounder? So how would you know? Okay. Anyways, next. The next definition of bishul akum is, it has to be something that's ba'ala lafot at a pot, which basically means it has to be something that comes to be eaten together with bread, which means on a halachic level, it means it has to be part of the main meal, served at the main meal of a suda, of a banquet, as opposed to something that's eaten as an appetizer or something that's eaten as a dessert. In other words, all kinds of yummy desserts don't fall under the gezeira of bishul akum. And it also includes snack foods and candy and tea and coffee, for that matter. All these things are not ba'al lafot at the pot. They're not part of the main meal. And therefore, there's no gezeira of bishul akum as far as that's concerned. Yes?
But hamburgers and hot dogs would fall under that category of bishul akum.
No. Again, what I'm giving you definitions. It has to fall under all these definitions. If once it falls out of any one of these single ones, it's no longer a problem of bishul akum. Okay, these are, if you want to call them, a list of heterim of bishul akum. Yeah.
Your first example was a baked potato. Does that fall under?
Of course it is.
Main part of a meal.
Of course it's part of main part of a meal. What are you talking about?
Maybe a shiva.
No. No, I didn't say the main. I didn't say the main part of the meal. A main part of the meal, meaning it's like, you know.
It's not an appetizer.
It's not a dessert. Okay. Fourth definition, and this has to do with defining an akum. Okay. There's some Rishonim that mention the fact that if you own a slave, okay, that a slave, being that you own a slave, doesn't fall under the gezeira of bishul akum. Okay, the Ravid extends this shita not only to slaves, but even to servants that are hired to work in your house. Being that they're part of your household and they're working in your house, according to the Ravid's understanding, there's not a gezeira of bishul akum. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes the following. He says, Yesh misha matir b'shifchot shelanu. There are those that are matir, the cooking of our maids. Yesh misha oser And there are those that we show them that say it's also a filu b'diavad, even if she already cooked it, even if the food was already cooked. So the Shulchan Aruch brings down both there in both directions. Then the Rama says, u'b'diavad yesh l'smocha divrei hamatirim. B'diavad meaning if she already cooked it, you could be somech on the sheet of the Ravid that, you know, she's a worker in the household and therefore it's mutter b'diavad. And then the Rama says, v'afilu l'chatchila nohagim l'hakel b'beit Yisrael sh'ashifchot v'avadim mivashlim b'beit Yisrael ki i'afshar sh'lo yichate echad me'b'nei bayit ma'at. The Rama is basing himself on a Trumat Hadeshen that says two things. It's almost like a sveik sveika, meaning maybe the Ravid is right and it's completely mutter l'chatchila, and even if the Ravid's wrong, there's a chance that one of the Jewish members of the household maybe stirred the pot while it was cooking, and because of that sveik sveika, so the Trumat Hadeshen felt that you could be somech l'chatchila and allow the maid to cook with no, you know, with no other type of restriction. Rav Lichtenstein told me that somebody should not, we should not be somech on this sheet of the Rama l'chatchila. In other words, you should not allow your maid to cook unaided for you. B'diavad, if she did cook, so then it's you could be somech on the Rama that it's kosher, that doesn't fall under the issur of bishul akum. Let me go on to the next definition, and that has to do with defining bishul. The Shulchan Aruch says that if a Jew stirs the pot, okay, then that is no longer a problem of bishul akum. In other words, if the Jew takes part in the essential cooking of the item, and this is only, by the way, before it's finished cooking. Once it's finished cooking, if the soup is already cooked, it doesn't help to stir. However, the Shulchan Aruch holds turning on the fire and definitely throwing in a match or throwing in a twig or whatever won't help, according to the Shulchan Aruch. The Rama disagrees and says that not only is stirring good, but even if you start the fire or even if you just throw in a twig while it's cooking into the fire, any amount of contribution that a Jew does in the cooking process renders it no longer a problem of bishul akum. Even as an example, if a Jew lights the pilot flame, in the good old days, they used to have stoves used to have like a pilot flame. It was a constant flame that when you would turn the knob of the gas, it would get the flame from the gas. So according to the Rama, that would no longer be a problem of bishul akum. Rav Lichtenstein and the Shach both feel that you should not be somech on this Rama l'chachila. However, Rav Lichtenstein feels that you could combine the two Ramas, the two situations, meaning if it's a guy under your employment and you start the fire or stir the food, then it wouldn't be a problem with bishul akum. So, if you have maids at home, what you have to really do l'chatchila is to tell the maid that she should not cook unless somebody turns on the fire first. Okay? Or somebody has to stir the food before it's cooked. That's how she should be instructed l'chatchila. Bid the avid, if she went ahead and cooked anyway, so then you'd be able to be somech on the Rama. Yes?
The definition of, I don't know, like serving for a king, does that mean the type of food or like...
Type of food.
Oh, so even if a badly cooked steak, that would still...
Right. Yes, Shem.
L'chatchila came from Aaron. What is the best... How much participation did you have to have with the goy in order for that?
Any participation before the food is completely cooked. You could turn on the fire, you could put the pot on the fire, you could stir the food.
That's only if they're working for you.
Huh?
That's only if they're working. You're saying stop, right. Like there's a goy, your neighbor is cooking,
then you'd have to put the pot on the fire.
Okay.
Yes?
I was speaking to Mashiach, and he said that it can't just be a normal Jew, it has to be a religious Jew.
There's a machloket in that, and most kashrus agencies are machloket that it has to be a religious Jew, but yeah.
So is this the reason why whenever you have to go to a kosher restaurant and there's a non-Jew serving us food, the reason why it's allowed is because a Jew took part in the cooking?
Absolutely. Awesome. Absolutely. I'll tell you, I think I told you guys a story. As I told you in the beginning of the year, if anybody finds himself in a situation with a restaurant where he's not sure about the hashgacha, he could give me a call if he doesn't want to speak to Mashgiach himself. So like 5 years ago, a guy called me on a Matzah Shabbos. Did I tell you the story?
Yeah.
I did. It was Bishlapim. It was, you know, a serious problem. And there was a Mashkiach said that, oh, they don't pay me to come down on Matzah Shabbos, and on Matzah Shabbos, it's all Bishlapim. Because the Mashkiach was basically telling, you know, saying, giving the testament that he is, you know, somehow involved in feeding non-kosher food to all the people that walk around on Matzah Shabbos. But yeah, it's a serious issue. To have the Mashkiach has to be there to turn on the fire. Yeah. Yes.
Does the two things? One is the part about servants. Is that only home servants as opposed to somebody working in a restaurant as a paid job?
I'm not sure. I think there's some on that as well. But definitely within the context of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, they're talking about home servants.
That's definitely okay. And then also, is it the what if something is before putting it on the plane, for example, mixing the dough, let's say, right, or some kind of or a batter, would that be considered enough?
No.
It has to be one step.
The cooking process. Yeah.
I've seen in the kitchen of the shul that all the like Mashiach did was turn on the flame and then, you know, just like walk around his place turning on flames.
Right.
But you said that that's only if it's like a worker in the house, that if it's not.
No. He asked me, does it, I said the Mashmah of the Shulchan Aruch is a worker in the home. Does it extend also to anybody hired? I'm not sure. So I would imagine that that's what caterers are being summoned on, that also applies to that. Or they're just being summoned on the sack of the Ramah. In other words, I said that Rav Lichtenstein says you should have both together. It's Rav Lichtenstein. Now the Ramah doesn't think you need both together. The Shach thinks you need, you know, maybe both together. But the Ramah says you don't need. It's one or the other. And that's what they're being some of them. Yeah.
Also, for things you buy, like the average things you buy in a supermarket that aren't from a Jewish company, for example, like an Entenmann's donuts.
So yes. If it has an OU on it, so the OU is make sure that the Mashkiach turns on the fires.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's not just because, like, it's none to do with the fact they're machine made or anything?
No. A kashrus organization cannot give a hashgacha on food that has bishul. Bishul akum is treif. You cannot eat it. It's not like a minhag. It's treif. It's a gezeid rabban. It's not kasher. Yeah.
Is that the reason why if you go to, like, a non-Jewish event and a student, they said because should be mincheck is double wrap.
No, the kosher food was already cooked by Jews. It's just being reheated by the non-Jew. Once it's being cooked by a Jew, it's not an issue. The double wrap. The reason why it's double wrapped is because, according to most Mishitot, if there's meat, you have to have like a double simon on it because of a different issue of basar shenit alim
min ha'ayin. No, I mean before, like it's like enclosed, like it's not
double wrapped, like an airline thing.
Yeah, the plastics
still
coming
in. Double wrap, right. But it has nothing to do with bishul. It has to do with kashrut. Yeah.
Food that is entirely made by machinery, the machinery is owned by a goat. Would that be bishul akum, or is that not considered bishul akum?
I think it would all depend on who presses the button.
Okay.
Not who owns the machinery. Yeah, any other questions? Yes.
The opposite case of when a deer presented, let's say you see a Jewish guy pick up the food, or let's say a Jewish guy takes out the food, but let's say a non-Jewish guy cooks the food, would that be enough involvement?
No. If the non-Jew finished the process of the cooking and it's done, there's nothing the Jew can do anymore to change it. Okay? Alright. Another definition is that when it comes to pickling or smoking, there's no issue of bishul akum. Okay, if a non-Jew pickles or smokes something, that's not bishul akum, even though it renders it edible, but they weren't gozer. Okay, if you have a situation of bishul akum, it would render the pots themselves non-kosher. Okay, if you find yourself in the workplace or in a dorm where a non-Jew, you know, used your frying pan to fry up eggs or something like that, so then you'd have to kasher the frying pan. Okay, I'm not going to get into that now. The kasher. Okay, that's as far as bishul akum. Now we go on to another gezeira, chalav akum. The reason why Chazal will go there on Chol of Atom is not because of Chatnut, it's not because of socializing the Jews, but rather because of a chash of non-kosher animals in the farm, that sometimes the farmer would like milk the horses, milk the pigs in order to augment the volume of milk that he had to sell. So Chazal saw that that was becoming a problem, and therefore they made a gzerah of Chalav Atum. Now the question is, what if in your in a situation where it's virtually impossible for non-kosher milk to get mixed into the kosher milk? As an example, you have, you know, a company with, I don't know, 10,000 cows, and there's not a non-kosher animal anywhere, you know, in the vicinity anywhere. Or let's say you're talking about, you have governmental agencies that make sure that no other milk could possibly get in there. Would the gezeirah also apply? When it was the gezeirah only in an atmosphere where it was a safek, where you didn't have supervision of any level? Or, you know, or is it only when there was a distinct possibility? So here there's a machloket poskim. Rav Moshe Feinstein was known to have paskin. He did paskin that if you have a government agency and it's virtually impossible for non-kosher milk to get in there, so the gezeirah of chalav akum doesn't apply. Okay, and that would, you can call it like stam chalav, meaning it's not chalav akum, but it's not quite chalav Yisrael. Chalav Yisrael means that a Jew is giving the supervision over the milking process, okay, until it gets put into a container that has some kind of a siman, some kind of a mark on it. That's Chalav Yisrael. Okay, anyway, so Moshe was matir. Rabbi Yoshev, as an example, holds that it's osur. Another interesting question is that according to Kol HaDeot, when the Chazal goes there on the milk, they weren't goes there on the butter. And this is really part of this reasoning. Now, how could it be that they weren't goes there on the butter?
You can't make
butter without milk, so it had to first be milk before it became butter. And as soon as the guy milked the cow, that's chalav akum. So how does chalav akum become mutter once it's in butter? So the point is that Chazal realized that the nature of butter making and the nature of goyim was such that they were so worried that if any foreign matter got into the milk, it wouldn't turn into butter. So much so that they had all kinds of superstitious practices to keep certain things away from the churning process of the butter, because sometimes it wouldn't turn into butter. They therefore Chazal weren't gozer on butter, and they weren't gozer on milk that was destined to become butter.
What about cheese?
Oh, so what about cheese? So here there's two separate minhagim. Some people have the minhag that it wasn't on cheeses either, and therefore basically it wasn't on any solid product of milk. While other people know hate that it applies to cheese as well. Okay, so you got that. So those people who are not samach on Rav Moshe Feinstein's heter, and they believe that even, you know, in highly regulated government industries, government regulated industries, that the gezeirah kol ha'akum still applies. It doesn't apply to butter according to most minhagim, and according to some minhagim, it doesn't apply to cheese. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein told me that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal was makbid on Chol of Yisrael, except he held that just like when it becomes butter, it becomes mutter. When it becomes solidified, it becomes mutter. So whenever any, you know, milk becomes solidified, it's basically mutter, not limited only to butter or cheese, but also to ice cream or frozen milk. And he said that once he went to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's house where there wasn't any milk, Chol of Yisrael milk available, so he asked his wife to bring out the ice cream, which was just regular OU ice cream, and he took a scoop and put it into his coffee. In other words, he held that even if you had an Isra of Chol Yisrael and Chalav, all you had to do is solidify it, and even though you're going to change it back to a liquid when you consume it, it would no longer be a problem of Chol Yisrael. Very interesting shita. You know, like a freezing process to kosher milk, so to speak. Yes? No, it's not a question of kosher agencies. They're Jews that are makbid on Chol Yisrael. So when they buy cheese, they'll buy cheese that says on it Chol Yisrael. Well, okay? All right. The next gezeira that Chazal will gozer on was Yayin. Okay. Now we're not talking about Yayin Nesach. Yayin Nesach, God was gozer on. Okay. That's in the Torah. Yayin, you know, is wine that was used for Avodah Zarah. You are not allowed to drink. That's Yayin Nesach. You're not allowed to get Hanah from. Chazal will gozer on wine that was touched or poured by a non-Jew. And the reason why they will gozer, again, is because of Chatnut. Specifically because of Chatnut. And it's a little complicated, all the halachas of Yayin Nesach or Stam Yeinam, but in a nutshell, basically, you can't, a non-Jew cannot pour an open bottle of, obviously, the only way to pour an open bottle, can't even shake an open bottle of wine, and can't pour wine, and if he or she touches the wine, it also becomes Stam Yeinam. Not literally Yayin Nesach, but Stam Yeinam. Unless the Yayin was Mevushal. If it was Yayin Mevushal, so then it can't become Stam Yeinam. Next, Gezeira. Chazal Gozer and it was interesting, I'll tell you in a second how I discovered this halacha. Chazal Gozer, it's on beer of Akum. Say Gemara Nevoah D'Zara, Yerodea, Shulchan Aruch Yerodea Kuf Yudalet, beer manufactured by a non-Jew. Chazal Gozer, you're not allowed to drink. Because of Chatnut, because again, you don't not to socialize with non-Jews. So the question is, how do we drink the beer that we drink? Okay, not like beer Yisrael. There's no din of a beer Yisrael or something like that. Why do we drink it? So the Rama says that the gezeira that Chazal made was on the beer of their day. The beer of their day was made out of dates. It was date beer. So the gezeira of beer Akum only applies to date beer. It doesn't apply to our beer, says the Rama. Okay, who lived, okay, in a place that they drank a lot of beer. And therefore there was no, you know, when you make beer from barley and hops and whatever, rye and whatever else they put into the beer there, that the gezeira of beer Akum doesn't apply because there wasn't such a beer in those days. Yes? Pardon me? Again, the same thing applies, what the Rama says, that when they were gozer on the alcohol that existed in their day. The only alcohol that existed in their day was wine or beer. Whiskey, the distillation process was not developed in the times of the Gemara, and therefore they couldn't have made whiskey, scotch, or bourbon, or any of these other things. They couldn't have. Okay? Of course, one has to consider the spirit of the law. That Chazal were looking to basically outlaw any type of alcoholic drink that existed in their time. They were just not capable of outlawing drinks that didn't exist in their time. And the spirit of the law, the spirit of the halacha basically says you should not be drinking alcohol with a non-Jew. But halachically, purely halachically, there's no isser. Yes.
Does that mean
the gezeira
is mevutal?
It's not mevutal. It doesn't apply on drinks that didn't exist.
If you were to make a date beer today, it would be.
Not me, because I'm not a goy. But if a goy would.
If a goy was to make date beer, it would still be. Absolutely.
Would it only be beer?
Beer.
If you made date liqueur or date something else.
I think it would be beer. It would be a beer anyway. In other words, you're assuming beer like has bubbles in it.
Sure.
Right, but you know, not necessarily. You know, it's the first process of wine, of any kind of wine, is that it has bubbles and later it kind of like loses it. So I don't think it would be limited to dates. Now, how did I come across this date beer thing? Actually, was on a date. I went out with this girl, okay, and at the end of the date, I said, I really had a good time, you know, I'd like to see you again. So she says, okay, you know. I said, where would you like to go? So she says, she mentioned whatever, some name, I don't remember the name anymore. And I said, well, I've never been to that restaurant. So she says, it's not a restaurant, it's a bar. And I said, huh? Oh, I didn't say it in such, you know, loud, but inside, I said, huh? I said to myself, am I interested in continuing dating a girl that wants to go to a bar? You know, I wasn't raised in such a fashion, you know, yeshiva guys don't go to bars. So I said to her, you seriously want to go to, she says, yeah, you know, everybody does it. I said, what, everybody? I said, I tell you something, from the little bit I know, it's got to be awesome. So I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to continue, you know, pursuing the relationship. But then at the moment I had this brilliant idea, and I said to her, look, I said, I'm convinced that there's got to be some kind of a halacha against this. But what we'll do is the next date, we'll go to Central Park. Okay? You'll bring the food, and I'll bring the svarim. Okay? And we'll learn about it, we'll see. So I figured, if she passes that test, if she's interested in going out with a, you know, with a geek that's interested in bringing svarim on the second date, you know, she could redeem herself in doing that. And she agreed. And so I did my research, and I came across this Gemara of Odeh Zarah in the Ramah. And, you know, she bring the food, and we had the date, and it was there.
That's it.
I married her, yeah.